So good to be here, and just loved Wendy's testimony. And I think as we go now through Ruth chapter 4 and wrap up this this book that we've been doing through the summer, I'm sure our hearts are going to be even more encouraged, not by what I say, but by this book. Blessing that it is. Yeah, I guess you probably know it off by heart by now. But at the risk of repeating ourselves, I am going to do a resume, because I think it's helpful just to do it each week, so we get the heart. And if you've not been here for every week, it's just helpful. So, quick recap. So there's a famine in Bethlehem, and Naomi goes with her husband Elimelech and their two sons Mahlon and Chilion, uproot and go to a place called Moab, which is modern Jordan, to the east of the Jordan River. Naomi's husband dies and leaves her and her family to fend for themselves. She expresses bitterness that life has got so tough, and she's full of sorrow and at her plight. Then the sons marry Moab women. I always want to say Oprah, but it's Orpah. Moab women, Orpah and Ruth, who worship their own gods, foreign gods to Naomi and Elimelech's God, and not the true God of creation. Then the sons die. You know, it's not going too well. This whole book is lots of sort of tragedies and difficulties. Then Naomi hears that the famine is over and decides to return to Bethlehem, destitute, with the exception of some land which Elimelech owned. And so they return back to Jerusalem, to Bethlehem rather, and she tells her daughters-in-law, stay with your family and continue to worship your own gods. Don't think Naomi was a particularly good evangelist, but there you go. She tells them, worship your own gods, you stay, but God had chosen Ruth. God had got his hand on Ruth, and God had called Ruth, which is why, as we heard earlier, Ruth turns around and says, no, where you go, I'll go. And your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. And so you've got this wonderful sense that irrespective of what Naomi said, God had got his hand on Ruth, and she was going to go with Naomi back to Bethlehem. Amazing act of devotion. So then, to survive, Ruth gathers leftover grain in the harvest fields, where she meets Boaz, who happens to be a relative of her late father-in-law, a wealthy and influential landowner. Boaz notices Ruth's hard work and her loyalty to Naomi, and he commands his workers to leave even more grain for her, looking out for her and ensures that she's safe and fed. Naomi realizes Boaz is this kinsman redeemer, that is, a family member, who in the culture of the day was able to buy back a deceased person's land and property and care for the widow. Following Naomi's advice, Ruth approaches Boaz at night on the threshing floor. Strange thing to do, but again, you have to understand this in the culture of the day. And effectively, she was asking him to marry her and redeem the family. Boaz jumps up, older man. So, I mean, and for Ruth, presumably as a younger woman, this was quite a thing, but Boaz gladly agrees, loves blossoms, and things start to look great. But hang on a minute. Boaz notes that a closer relative legally has right of first refusal to redeem the land. So this whole story of Ruth has its ups and its downs. And you could ask yourselves, why was the book written? Well, there's different aspects to that. I think we heard it earlier that the book of Ruth, the story, is a real story of what happens to real people. But at the same time, there's a hidden message in it as well, which goes way beyond that, which we will see when we get towards the end. But Thomas has always let the cat out of the bag that the true Redeemer is Jesus. So I'll say it now. That's where we're going. The true Redeemer is Jesus. But the answer is that life is full of ups and downs. And I think this book is written as much as anything to show that actually, this is what we can expect in life. Things aren't always easy. There are tragedies. But God remains faithful throughout, even when things don't look that way. There's always, always a bigger picture. So when you read Ruth as a complete story, it reflects what is common to life, what's common to you and to me. you know, the older I get, the more I realize that life is full of ups and downs. I've had great times, I've had rough times, I've had joyful times, I've had sad times. I've had times where I've done well, I've had times when I've not done well. I have times when I'm really looking forward to seeing the great Redeemer face to face when it will all be over. But he's going to be glorious anyway. And this is what you see what life is all about. And some of those hardships are outside of our control. You know, the famine was outside of their control. Others of the hardships actually are our own consequences of our own actions, things that we do, and things which aren't always wise. Was it wise to go to a foreign land and let the daughters marry Moab, the sons marry Moab women? Was that a wise thing to do? I don't know. Perhaps not. Certainly wasn't wise to encourage them to worship their foreign gods, not the true God. Then there's the big tragedies, like losing a husband and sons as well. And some seem to have it really tough. Some people in their lives have it a lot tougher than others. I've seen that sometimes. It feels like some people flow through life without any troubles. And others hit big troubles like dear Naomi and Ruth. But this book is written to see that in all these things, irrespective of our own personal circumstances, God remains faithful, God remains sovereign, God remains good, and can turn around every situation, bad decisions. So that's where we're going. And I've entitled this, is it working? Can you move me on one, please, Ed? I've entitled it, There is a Redeemer. And we're going to go through chapter 4. I think that's jumped one bit too far, but never mind. We'll work through it. Chapter 4, and we'll start at verse 1, working through to verse 4 or 5. Meanwhile, Boaz went up to the town gate and sat down there just as the guardian redeemer he had mentioned came along. Boaz said, "Come over here, my friend, and sit down." So he went over and sat down. Boaz took 10 of the elders of the town and said, "Sit here." And they did so. Then he said to the guardian redeemer, "Naomi, who has come back from Moab, is selling the piece of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. I thought I should bring the matter to your attention and suggest that you buy it in the presence of these seated here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, do so. But if you will not, tell me, so I will know. For no one has the right to do it except you, and I am the next in line." "I will redeem it," he said. You know, it's come up early, but Boaz is quite the deal. He really is a man full of integrity. He wants to do everything right. Clearly, he wanted to buy the land, and he wanted to be the redeemer. But hang on a minute, there's someone else who actually has legal right to it because he's a close relative. So rather than trying to avoid that, Boaz does exactly the right thing. And as the guardian redeemer, he doesn't say to the close relative, "I wish you weren't here. You're a right pain in the neck." He actually says, "Come here, my friend. My friend, the one who could actually take away everything that Naomi and Ruth were hopeful was going to happen. It could all turn around because Boaz could end up not being able to marry Ruth." And as the guardian redeemer approaches, he reaches out to him, calls him friend. You know, everything that Boaz has done right the way through this book of Ruth, he's done with integrity. He'd been honourable when Ruth first approached him in the threshing floor. He could so easily have compromised that and taken advantage of Ruth. He didn't. He did it with integrity. He waited for marriage before they were intimate together. Having realized his closest relative who had first rights on the land, he was going to offer that to him first. Integrity. And if that closer relative said yes, then he'd lose the land and Ruth, but he wanted to make sure things were done properly and in order. How easy it is for us to be tempted to do things our way rather than God's way. And when situations like this come up, big situations, and I'm sure we've all been in these situations, you think, if I just bend the rules just slightly, I'm sure I'll be able to get what I want. You know, have you ever been in that in a work situation? I know I have. I'll just bend the truth slightly because I know it's more likely to come about if I do it. You know, my promotion might come in place if I just do this or do that. No, Boaz wasn't going to do that. He was going to do everything with integrity. So in front of the witnesses, the elders of the town, so that's the formal way in which they did it, at the town gate where official business is undertaken, he offers the land to this close relative who says, yes. Oh, what looked like a great story suddenly looks like this is going pretty down the pan, certainly for Ruth. Boaz does what is right, and all of a sudden things don't look so good. Doing the right thing is isn't always easy. And we live in a culture increasingly where people don't do the right thing. Our culture is very different from what was happening here. Our politicians, not to get party political, but they lie. In our work situations, people will just always be nice. We live in a culture where it's me first. To do what Boaz did, which is the opposite, that's unusual. The normal thing is look after number one. The daily temptation we face to protect our own interests by not being entirely honest. We all face those temptations, and I dare say we've all succumbed to them from time to time, because to live with such integrity is hard in a culture which totally lacks integrity. You look at what's happening around our nation, I weep. I think, God, we desperately need you to move in our nation, because increasingly our nation is more and more godless. And then when you when you do come across someone who is godly, it makes you aware of your own sinfulness. You know, you remember when Peter was out and they were fishing, and Jesus says, "Turn, you know, put the nets the other side," and they get this enormous catch of fish. And Peter says, "Go away from me! I'm a man of sinful lips. I am a sinful man." And that's what, when you encounter righteousness, it makes you aware of your own sinfulness. And I guess. You know, Boaz really was the real deal. When you realize your sin, you realize how much you need a redeemer. When you realize how sinful we are and how far we've fallen, how much do we need a redeemer? And when you and I struggle to do the right thing, how we need to cry out to our redeemer, Jesus, who is able to help us. So let's read on. If we go to the next part of the passage, if we can click on that, Ed. There we go. Verse 5 through to 6, then Boaz said, "On the day you buy the land from Naomi, you also acquire Ruth, the Moabite, the dead man's widow, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property." At this, the guardian redeemer said, "Then I cannot redeem it, because I might endanger my own estate. You redeem it yourself. I cannot do it." Whoa, it's back on again. It's all right, Ruth. You've got him. Ruth must have been wondering what on earth was going on at this moment. And then suddenly she's got him back. It's going to happen. But there's a second aspect to this redemption, and it's not, and it's obvious, it's not just the land. Ruth is also part of the deal, which is a strange word. In other words, Ruth is also part of this transaction, not only the land, but when you take the land, you take Ruth as well. And in Jewish culture, the obligation to marry is put on the brother of the man who has died. Now, if we move on to Deuteronomy, you read it here in Deuteronomy chapter 5, it says this: "If brothers are living together and one of them dies without a son, his widow must not marry outside the family. Her husband's brother shall take her and marry her and fulfill the duty of a brother-in-law to her. The first son she bears shall carry on the name of the dead brother, so that his name will not be blotted out from Israel. The purpose was to preserve the deceased man's name and family line." So part of the Jewish culture was that if a brother dies and a wife is left a widow, then another brother takes her on so that the family line carries on. But, of course, here, there are no other brothers. Both have died. Neither this closer relative nor Boaz were Ruth's ex-husband's brother. So theoretically, according to the law, the guardian redeemer was not obliged to marry her. But the book of Ruth brings these two cultural things together. It brings the land and the carry on the family line through marriage together. Basically, these two principles are all tied up in this action of Boaz, the Redeemer, being able to take on not only the land, but also the wife, Ruth. So once again, this just shows what an amazing Redeemer Boaz is, because he's not thinking of himself, but he's thinking of what he can do to redeem the land and the family line. And if we move on to the next, he is abounding in generosity. That's what you see here. Now look, to explain it's helpful just to go a bit more into this. Had the closer relative married Ruth, what would have happened is that all his estate will pass on to Ruth's son. So the family becomes Ruth's son, i.e., but basically it's that it's all taken from the family line. Is no the Redeemer could not hold on to his own estate. He loses it all. And this is what we're seeing here in such amazing generosity, that Boaz is able to take this. And he says, I don't care about my own estate. I care about serving Ruth and Naomi and following that family line through. So this shows just what amazing generosity Boaz has, that he's willing to sacrifice this in order to redeem the land. The other closer relative was not willing to do that. He was not willing to lose his own estate into this family line. What an amazing turnaround of events it is. It really is. What incredible generosity on the part of Boaz. Let's read on. So verse 7. Now in earlier times in Israel, for the redemption and transfer of property to become final, one party took off his sandal and gave it to the other. This was the method of legalizing transactions in Israel. So the guardian redeemer said to Boaz, buy it yourself. And he removed his sandal. Then Boaz announced to the elders and all the people, today you are witnesses that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. I write Mahlon's widow as my wife, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property, so that his name will not disappear from among his family or from his hometown. Today, you are witnesses. It's all done. Signed, sealed, and delivered. Well, actually, I say it's all done. They didn't actually sign it and seal it. They gave a smelly sandal. Don't know why they did that. Try that next time you try and sell a house or something. Send your smelly sandal to the solicitor and see if that works. I'm not sure. But that's what they did. It's all legal. In that culture, it's done. So the Redeemer gives his sandal to Boaz. It's a official action. The land, Ruth, Boaz, it's yours. Let's move on. Sorry. Yeah, that's it. He keeps his promises. This is what Boaz does. He keeps and fulfills his promises. No matter what the cost, he's willing to do what the closer relative was not willing to do. And he was willing to do that in danger of missing out he didn't want to miss out. He wanted to make sure he fulfilled everything. Boaz really is the real deal. Keeps his promises. But more than this, let's not forget that Ruth was a Moabite. She was from a foreign land. And with foreign customs. So think about this. Boaz, who is an Israelite, if you like, he's he is willing, not only taking on the land, he's taking on a foreigner, someone with different traditions, different backgrounds. He's willing to do that. She was from a foreign land, foreign customs, and yet Boaz totally willing to marry her and love her. There's probably a lot more to laying your life down here than meets the eye. There's a lot more to it. It's sacrificial love. A redeemer who is willing to lay down his life for his wife. I wonder if that's familiar, guys. to lay our lives down for our wife, which is what we're called to do. Husbands, we're called to lay our lives down for our wives. Paul said it in Ephesians chapter 5. There's a hint of this sacrificial love, that Boaz really is demonstrating what it is to keep promises here. Marriage is a covenant relationship. We promise till death parts us. And Boaz has counted the cost and he's willing to lay his life down in order to redeem the land, to redeem Ruth, to give his life to for this amazing purpose. Wonderful. Guys, let's never forget this, what it means for those of us who are married to lay our lives down for our wives. I need to continually learn it, continually. I do it. I lay my life down for my wife as an act of love and sacrificial love. And of course, we'll see more about this just a bit later. That's what Jesus did for us. Let's read on. Then the elders and all the people at the gate said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your home like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the family of Israel. May you have standing in Ephrathah and be famous in Bethlehem. Through the offspring the Lord gives you by this young woman, may your family be like that of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah." So now the elders are pronouncing this blessing over the marriage, this blessing over this transaction. Boaz is to be a redeemer who brings blessing. Not just that Ruth will have children by Boaz, but that she'll be like Rachel and Leah. Now, you'll know, Rachel and Leah, they were Jacob's wives. And together, they gave birth to 12 children who became the 12 tribes of Israel. Okay? Blessing. Huge blessing. Not just any, don't be just be like any old wife. She's going to be like Rachel and Leah, 12 tribes of Israel. And when you read that story, that's interesting because, you see, Rachel and Leah, if you go back over that in Genesis, there's this going back and forth of their wombs being shut, as it puts it in the Bible. In other words, were they going to conceive? One conceives, then the other conceives. And God is in control of everything. And then I guess Ruth didn't know whether she was going to conceive. She hadn't had any children via her first husband. Was she going to have any children via Boaz? But then this promise that may that blessing be that she has like the 12 tribes of Israel. God is in control whether someone gets pregnant or not. And every conception is from the Lord. This is a wonderful promise. Ruth had not had any children from Mahlon, but now there's this blessing that she might have like the 12 tribes of Israel. But then what's the significance of Perez, who Tamar brought to Judah? So this reflects another story in the Bible. Tamar and Ruth actually have very similar stories. So the comparison shows how God uses unconventional, vulnerable and non-Israelite women to build the nation of Israel. So Tamar was likely a Canaanite, not an Israelite, likely a Canaanite. Ruth was a Moabite, member of a nation traditionally excluded from the assembly of Israel. Tamar also had an unusual marriage. Tamar's husband had died without giving her a child. Her father-in-law, Judah, should have allowed her, his youngest son, to marry Tamar and fulfill his responsibility. Now, what goes on here is not like Boaz. There's a lack of integrity here. Because what happens here is that Tamar goes and feigned prostitution, and Judah, her father, ends up being fathering Perez through Tamar. So like Tamar, despite Ruth's outsider status, the blessing was being pronounced that her offspring would be a blessing. In other words, yeah, may you have the children like the tribes of Israel, but also you're an outsider and you are brought right in, which is amazing. This Ruth the Moabite is brought right in, like Tamar, as an outsider. Did Elimelech and Naomi do the right thing in going to Moab in the first place? Now, this is an interesting question, because I suggested perhaps it wasn't wise for Naomi and Elimelech to go to Moab and then their sons to marry Moabite women who worshipped foreign gods. Did they sin in doing that? Just a question. They had to escape the famine, but was it the wise thing to do? Well, not only that Naomi actively encouraged her daughter-in-laws to go back and serve their foreign gods and not the true God, that it clearly was, if you like, a sinful act. Where am I going with this? Does this mean that God condones sin? Absolutely not. But does it mean that he's sovereign over sin? Absolutely yes, which is in itself amazing. He's a gracious and forgiving and still blesses us despite our mistakes and our mucking up. Absolutely yes, God is sovereign over every action, over things which are outside of our control and things which we do which are inside our control when we sin. God is sovereign over our own mistakes and rebellion, and he can turn around what may be meant as evil for good. We all make mistakes. We all sin. But God still, in his sovereignty, can use our failures to bring glory to him. He did it through Tamar, who feigned as a prostitute. He does it through Ruth, who's a Moabite, who's outside serving foreign gods. But suddenly, she's owned by the one and only true God and bought into the family line. This is amazing mercy and act of grace of God. Let's read on. Verses 13. So Boaz took Ruth, and she became a wife. When he made love to her, the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. The women said to Naomi, "Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a guardian redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth." Then Naomi took the child in her arms and cared for him. The women living there said, "Naomi has a son," and they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David. Now, in verse 16, Ruth disappears from the story, and Naomi is again the focus. The women say, "Naomi has a son." Well, that's strange. It's Ruth, but no, Naomi has a son. It's Naomi who has not been left without a guardian redeemer. And again, there's the prayer, of almost like a prophecy from the women. May he become famous throughout Israel and renew your life in your old age. This redeemer, Boaz, is going to bring life. What a redeemer. It's amazing. Can Boaz give Naomi life in her old age? Because when you read in this book, actually Boaz is old himself. So here comes a question. Who actually are the women speaking about? Are they speaking about Boaz? Well, I mean, as far as the property and the family is concerned, that seems to be the case. But as you read this passage in verses 14 and 15, it actually seems that they're talking about the child, Obed. Obed will bring blessing in your old age. Obed, the child, is the redeemer. And the son's name, Obed, means worshipper or servant. So what Naomi doesn't know is that this child is going to be the father of Jesse, who is the father of David. He's going to bring life. The Ruth, the foreigner, brought into the family line, the Moabite, better than seven sons, because this child, Obed, is no ordinary child. Life is going to come from him now. How does that happen? Let's read on. The genealogy of David, it says. This then is the family line of Perez. Perez was the father of Hezron. Hezron, the father of Ram. Ram, the father of Amminadab. Amminadab, the father of Nashon. Nashon, the father of Salmon. Salmon, the father of Boaz. Boaz, the father of Obed. Obed, the father of Jesse. And Jesse, the father of David. So Boaz may have been the redeemer of the property and family line, but Obed's going to be the father of Jesse. And Jesse, who is David? Let's read this passage in 2 Samuel 7. David the king. And this is what was declared over him. "The Lord declares to you that the Lord himself will establish a house for you. When your days are over and you rest with your ancestors, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you, your own flesh and blood, and I will establish his kingdom. He is the one who will build a house for my name and will establish the throne of his kingdom forever." So this family line from Obed now goes down to King David. King David doesn't build the temple. Solomon, his son, builds a temple. But Nathan the prophet's not talking about the temple here. He's talking about David's lineage. Then the line of David leads to the ultimate redeemer. And who is the ultimate redeemer? Ed, if you can move us on, his name is Jesus. Jesus is the ultimate redeemer. What an amazing turnaround of events. Jesus is the ultimate redeemer who, had Boaz not married Ruth, then Obed would not have been born, and then the line would not have gone down to King David and through to Jesus. Jesus, whose earthly lineage goes back to King David, and his kingdom will never, ever end. And that's our glorious hope, that Jesus' kingdom, he is going to return one day and establish his kingdom. No more sin, no more sickness, no more death. Everything's going to be beautiful when Jesus returns, and it all comes through to Jesus. Jesus is the one who's full of integrity. Jesus is the one who is abounding in generosity. Jesus is the one who keeps his promises. Jesus is the one who brings blessing. And Jesus is the one who brings life. And the amazing thing about this story of Ruth is that God is sovereign over our mistakes. He gets hold of the outsider, the foreigner, and includes them in his purposes. God turns what seems like tragedy into good. God is ultimately faithful. Jesus is the true Redeemer. And that's why throughout the book of Ruth, when we have been looking at it, and Thomas has been desperate to come to this all the time because he keeps on hinting at it. And you sang There Is a Redeemer last week, which we were going to sing today, but not, because actually the whole book says there is a Redeemer. So this amazing book of Ruth, which is written to show that life is full of ups and downs, that there's tragedies, but through it all, God is sovereign. And of course, Ruth didn't know. She didn't know that the ultimate redeemer was going to be Jesus. She didn't know that the lineage went down to David. And sometimes we don't even know with our own lives where it's ultimately going to lead. But when we recognize that God is sovereign and in control, amazing things can happen. So we're going to worship. We're going to take communion. I suggest that what we do is, I don't know if you want to lead us through this, Thomas, but it'd be good for us to take the bread and the juice, and perhaps individually. And as we do that, just consider this amazing Redeemer, Jesus, who has redeemed us from, paid the biggest debt you can possibly imagine. We don't tend to use the term redeemer in modern society. There's one aspect where we do use it. If you pay off a mortgage, which I did many years ago, I got a redemption certificate. The redemption certificate says the debt's been paid. It's all dealt with. It's done. Jesus, our Redeemer, has given us a redemption certificate. Our sin is paid for on the cross. What an amazing Redeemer. Should we stand and worship and then take communion?